Support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Tracy Ray from the employment law firm of Baron Liebman. Tracy says that OPB sponsorship is a great way to support the community and connect with Baron Liebman's clients.
It's OPB Politics Now for Friday, May 3rd. Well, that was a slow news week, huh? We had campus protests, the elections around the corner, ballots should be on the way to your mailbox, and the governor finally brought some clarity to what exactly she wants her wife to do or not do. Or did she? We'll take a close look at the office of the first spouse and take a jaunt through more than 6,000 pages of emails to try to examine what it all means, what the governor is saying about it, and whether any of this is any clearer than it was a few days ago. Welcome to the podcast. I'm OPB Politics editor Andrew Thien.
I'm OPB Politics reporter Lauren Dake.
And I'm OPB Politics reporter Dirk Vanderhart.
Okay, Lauren, before we dive into the specifics of what Governor Kotek said or didn't say this week at a press conference, let's go all the way back to last week, Friday, April 26th. It's not every day that 6,000 pages of public records arrive in your inbox, so remind us the backstory that led to this big records dump and what exactly was requested.
Okay, so after we learned that three of the governor's top aides, including her chief of staff, all pretty much left at the exact same time, we obviously started asking some questions. It started to seem really likely that these three women left because of some tension surrounding the governor's wife, Amy Kotek Wilson. So we, along with most media organizations, requested records to figure out what was going on. So last Friday, they released the emails, like you said, thousands of pages of emails that did confirm this narrative that the governor's most loyal, most experienced staffers, her top aides, were growing increasingly concerned about the role that her wife was playing in her administration. The back and forth contained in these emails really illustrate how these women were working to create boundaries around the First Lady's involvement and pushing for clarity about what the office of the first spouse would look like. When they felt like the governor and her wife were moving ahead quite quickly without using their input.
So you and Dirk were keeping a close eye on these emails from these three staffers that you kind of alluded to there. There were some telling exchanges, right, in these documents. What stood out?
There were a lot of telling exchanges. One definitely stood out. There was one where the governor's top aides had an exchange with the governor's behavioral health advisor. Okay, so the top aide is Abby Tibbs. Mm-hmm. The governor's behavioral health advisor is Juliana Wallace. The email makes it clear that the governor told Wallace, the behavioral health advisor, to get involved in a dispute on behalf of the first lady's friend at a private nonprofit. Tibbs, the aide, who is also a lawyer, tells Wallace in an email that that request by the governor, and I'm going to quote her here, was highly inappropriate at best. And then Tibbs goes on to imply that this is not the first time the governor and the first lady have made these type of requests. In another email, Tibbs was straightforward again, and she just said, hey, there are some very complicated legal, ethical workplace concerns around the first lady's involvement. She ended one email reminding the governor that she had an obligation to not only meet, but exceed ethical obligations to keep the public's trust. So at this point in the records, the governor's aides are really documenting some of their concerns and pushing the governor. And it's noteworthy that they're putting it in writing. It seems evident that they want to be on the record as pushing for this, which I believe points to them not feeling heard.
Okay.
And, you know, I think those are some of the most significant ones. There's also just some really illustrative stuff in there. Like, I'm thinking of an email from late January, where Lindsay O'Brien, one of these aides that left, reaches out to the First Lady's sort of scheduling assistant and says, hey, I got a call from Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, Christina Stevenson. She's got a meeting with the governor coming up, and she wondered why all of a sudden the First Lady is scheduled to attend. Is there some scheduling change or topic change we need to be aware of? I think just these little things that sort of get to this expanding role that the First Lady was having and why how it sometimes maybe surprised people that all of a sudden she was going to be in the room.
She was in the room, and she was in the emails and mentioned in the emails, as you both have talked about. It's so hard when there's that many documents to wrap your head around them. And Dirk, you spent some time over the weekend, as reporters do, setting a timeline of exactly how this played out over time.
Yep.
How did it play out? When did concerns start popping up from staff?
Yeah, we have sort of a limited period of time that we're dealing with here, essentially from the beginning of the year on. But what does become clear in those records is that, as we've said, the role of the First Lady seemed to become an ever-escalating source of concern for people. So, for instance, in January, we see records where Cooper, this departed chief of staff, isn't happy that state police are now providing bodyguard protection for Kotek Wilson and also driving her around on a routine basis. She's not thrilled with the fact that Kotek Wilson's schedule is demanding more governor's office staff. So policy advisors, communications team members needing to staff her at these events. But then as it becomes clear that Kotek actually is moving beyond that, more forcefully toward creating an actual office of the first spouse, I think we see things seem to get more animated. In early February, some of these senior aides even suggested hiring a professional facilitator that might help them work with the governor in creating this office. I mean, that seems to be a hint of fairly serious tensions. At least that's what it reads like. And then I think once it becomes clear, right, that after all this discussion, this mediation, whatever, that Kotek's just going to move forward, maybe even beyond her aides or over her aides' objections, I think we see things really start to move quickly. That hire is announced March 8th. By the following week, there are these long email threads, one of which Lauren referred to, that include very serious questions about what an office of the First Lady means to the governor's office, the ethical, legal resource issues they might pose. And then by March 15th, Abby Tibbs is suggesting she's headed out the door. By March 20th, Andrea Cooper, the chief of staff, appears to have been fired. We report on these departures on March 22nd. So it really, really snowballs at the end there, it seems.
So this is all not a great look when you look at all these emails in totality and you see the concerns that you just both laid out. And that leads us to earlier this week on Wednesday. There's news of a press conference in Salem. Set the scene.
Yeah. You know, we'd been wondering, obviously, I think a lot of people had, when the governor might set something up to address this. I think she often will do that. And, you know, particularly because I think some of the things revealed in these emails were different from what the governor had told reporters in the past. We met with her on April 3rd, and she said, look, you know, our office has only just started thinking through the sort of ethical implications of having a first spouse. We're going to ask the Ethics Commission about it. But the emails show pretty clearly her staff had been posing these kinds of questions for a long time. And also that she'd quietly sort of been moving forward with a decision to create an office of the first staff prior to these things spilling into public view and then sort of saying, oh, we're just in early days. So Kotek calls a press conference for Wednesday. And I think at first we're expecting just sort of her to field questions, not any big announcement. But the morning of the event, that changes. We got word from the governor's office that Kotek was going to be announcing she decided not to create an office of the first spouse, that she wouldn't be hiring a chief of staff for her wife. So, you know, we went there, obviously eager to hear more.
You've both seen Governor Kotek dozens, if not hundreds of times in person over the years covering the legislature. What was the sense of how she is processing this ongoing issue in her office? You know, it's not just a personnel issue. It's a spousal issue. It's a family issue and it's a workplace issue. She's a private person. She doesn't like talking about these things, Lauren.
No, Kotek is an experienced, savvy politician. And that is why, in a lot of ways, this is surprising. She's an incredibly strategic person. She's smart. Even a top Republican I spoke to said he was surprised by just how bungled this has become. Mm-hmm. Like, what a mess it is. I mean, even the governor herself described it on Wednesday as a mess. Mm-hmm. But it's just clear when it comes to her wife, it's a bit of a weakness for her. I mean, she did not move as intentionally as she would have with other issues. It also appears she didn't listen to her advisors when they were seemingly really looking out for her best interests here. She even noted that this whole debacle, she said, was not on her brand.
Right.
So, yeah, she's typically a very private individual when it comes to her personal life and much more comfortable talking policy. So, you know, I think this entire experience has just not been very comfortable for her.
So she talked for a long time. She took all comers, took as many questions, I think, as folks had in the room. What were the pressure points during her appearance? I mean, what questions did she not want to answer, or what questions were not answered really directly, which I guess is not thoroughly unusual in politics, but...
No, but I think we should be very clear here, right? We all left this press conference kind of scratching our heads. And that's because, you know, on one hand, as you say, Andrew, the governor was making these very clear statements about not having a formal office of the first spouse or not hiring a chief of staff for her wife. She also said she's awaiting guidance from the Government Ethics Commission on what ultimately is permissible. Here's a bit of how she explained it.
We're not going to have an office of the first spouse. We're not going to have a chief of staff for the first spouse. Oregonians have been very clear. It's like, that's a little too much for us. So once we figure this out with more guidance, we will be back and say, okay, we've heard this. We can give you more answers.
I think the problem with that is that it's not at all clear that those lines she's drawing are ultimately meaningful on their own. I think the governor left a lot of wiggle room in her statements for Kotek Wilson to still have a potent role once the Ethics Commission weighs in on what is permissible. So, you know, for instance, the governor said again and again her wife would be doing things like attending tribal visits, going to events, meeting with members of the public in group forums, things like that. But she refused to answer questions about what Kotek Wilson won't be doing. She wouldn't say that she won't be doing some of the things like meeting one-on-one with officials on policy matters. She just wouldn't say any boundary that she would be drawing around her wife while we're awaiting clarity. She just wanted to say what would be happening. And, you know, even though she says her wife won't have a chief of staff, she made clear that Kotek Wilson will still have at least one assistant, will still be able to use office space in the governor's office. So it kind of just feels like a holding pattern in some ways of what has been happening for months and months now, not really any definitive decision curtailing much. And just to answer your question a bit more clearly, you know, there was a lot of things she didn't want to talk about. She would not answer questions about some of the criticisms that we've talked about that emerged in emails. She just refused. She declined to talk about legal opinions her staff had given her. She says she won't release any of those. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot that she will suggest is a personnel matter that she refuses to talk about still.
And she did talk at multiple times during the availability about how other states, as you both have reported, and I think we've talked on this podcast maybe weeks ago, other states have an office of the first spouse, and she is committed to exploring what that means.
And again, she will say often, there's no guardrails here. We don't have any clarity. One thing we should mention is that she says she's creating a manual, I guess, for how the first spouse will interact with her office moving forward. So that, I guess, is something we're waiting for.
Everybody loves a good manual.
Yeah.
Okay. So why did Kotek decide, though, ultimately to step back from the edge here? What drove her decision?
Yeah, I mean, what she said is she's heard a lot since all this came out from Oregonians who had concerns about the first lady's role, and that she took those concerns seriously, so was sort of reacting here and drawing these lines. I think she suggested this shows she's a governor that listens to feedback, that she reacts accordingly. I would say that self-assessment seems to sort of conveniently leave out the fact that these emails show she didn't have the same reaction when her top aides were raising concerns, which is what got us here. And we should also note that Kotek sounded a note of regret about this. I think Lauren mentioned that. I mean, she acknowledged this was sloppy. Here's what it sounded like.
I've gotten a lot done in my first year. My team has gotten a lot done in the first year. We've been super successful. And this hasn't been smooth. I will admit that. I mean, we've hit some bumps. We haven't, I don't think, communicated well. And for those of you who know me, that's not particularly on brand.
It is not that common, or has not been that common, in this governor's administration to date for Kotek to apologize. And she outright said on this, I apologize to Oregonians for the way we've communicated this. So that's, I think, striking in its way.
It's certainly notable. One of the things that it felt like reporters were asking and Oregonians have to be wondering is, why was creating the office of first spouse on their minds so early in the administration? Was this a notion she wanted to pursue during the campaign?
No. I mean, at least that's not how she described it on Wednesday, though she did note, you know, Kotek Wilson appeared in campaign ads. It's not like she had been utterly invisible or hiding, right? She's been upfront about her spouse. What the governor suggested was that the first lady's role had seemed to come about somewhat organically as she, you know, was governor for the first year. As I think we've talked about on the podcast, Kotek Wilson is a person who has a background in politics, but also spent a brief amount of time as a social worker. And she's been public about living with a mental illness and struggling with alcohol use. So Kotek said a number of things. The first is that she and Kotek Wilson made a conscious decision that the first lady would not work an outside job while Kotek is governor. That's to avoid any possible conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. She also said her wife's lived experience is useful, you know, is something she can bring to bear and help sort of craft policy. And that input is necessary. And she also said Kotek Wilson's potential role in the administration sort of came more to the front as the two traveled around the state on this one Oregon tour that Kotek made a priority her first year. Here's some of what she said.
So she was on those trips, and we were hearing conversations on the trips about what people wanted to talk about around behavioral health. And I think things just kind of moved ahead without a lot of clarification.
And to your point, Andrew, they were also attending the National Governors Association event. They're seeing other first spouses have a chief of staff or maybe have a formal office. And maybe Kotek Wilson is getting a little envious. I don't know. I can't put thoughts in the first lady's head. But that is also something that the governor raised.
I think there's a piece of this that we haven't talked about yet. And the reason we probably care here in Oregon is because it's not that long ago that, you know, this was a politically fraught topic because of what happened to former Governor John Kitzhaber, who was, just in his fourth term, and the first fiance, Sylvia Hayes. That whole situation, his resignation, Lauren, it's still fresh in people's minds.
Yeah, it's recent history. But just to clarify, I mean, we largely care because this whole thing raises questions about how effective Kotek's office can be. You know, the women who left her office are her most senior brain trust. They're the ones widely credited with having helped, you know, bring the governor's vision to life. The state is facing so many crises right now, and that office has to function. If her staff are leaving because the governor's wife is contributing to an unhealthy workplace environment, and that's affecting state policy or productivity in that office, it becomes relevant to the public. And that's why we care. But it is true that I think one really real reason we are talking about this is because, yeah, not so long ago, we had a governor, John Kitzhaber, who resigned when his partner, Sylvia Hayes, was using the office to basically leverage her own career and make money off of it. This is different because Amy Kotek Wilson is not leveraging it for immediate financial gain. And, you know, like we've just talked about, mm-hmm. there are other states where the first spouse is involved. But in this state, there's just, like we've discussed, there's just not a lot of boundaries or guidelines over the role of the first spouse who is not elected should play in the governor's office. And then how you protect other employees who might disagree with their boss's spouse in the workplace. And just one last thing I want to mention. Nepotism in Oregon is really common. A lot of lawmakers have their spouse or their child working in their office, and that is the way it's just been for a very long time. But again, there's just not been any recent precedent, at least at the executive level, on a way to do that in an ethical way that doesn't create chaos so that we can just trust that our government officials are doing what people have elected them to do.
And, you know, forwarding the issue to the Ethics Commission is not, you know, a panacea for solving all of those problems.
Yeah, and we should know, I mean, I guess we should mention there are, the Ethics Commission is in the process of doing due diligence on a number of complaints surrounding this situation. They're going to make a formal decision coming up in June whether or not to actually investigate, and they're going to wait until that process is done before they offer any actual clarity on what the law is. So we might be waiting at least a month or two for any real sort of hardline opinion about how this all fits within state ethics laws.
Okay, so what is the political fallout here for Governor Kotek? She had, you know, as we've discussed here, it was a pretty productive start to her administration. Then there's this seemingly self-inflicted wound. We're kind of in the, you know, in between long session here, but she's apologized like we talked about, but there's still some unanswered questions. So where do we go from here?
I am sure that the governor and her spouse and the remaining staff are really hoping that her announcement this week puts an end to all this media coverage. I mean, that's why she announced that there will be no office of the first spouse for her entire tenure while she's governor. But like we've covered, there's still so many unanswered questions. You know, we asked the governor what the first lady will be doing. We did not get a lot of clarity. Like Dirk mentioned, she mentioned this idea of touring. She mentioned that a couple times. And, you know, a reporter did point out, you know, that is, nobody had problems with the first lady going on tours or going to the Japanese Garden when the governor couldn't make it. That was not what was the problem. So what will happen with the first lady's interaction with the governor's staff moving forward and how that might affect policy, that's what matters. And that's what we'll be keeping our eyes on.
Yeah, I don't think right now we see actually a lot of political fallout. I mean, the governor said she's heard from Oregonians that aren't too pleased or have questions. So potentially their voters could be slightly concerned. But when you talk to a lot of politicians, even people on the other side of the aisle, I mean, they're not saying this is corrupt, this is corrupt. I think a lot of people, though, are sort of raising their eyebrows and wondering if there's another shoe to drop, if there's another email, if there's something waiting in the wings in all this that might escalate things.
Yeah, she made a point to say she reads the coverage. She reads the emails. Her constituent services people read the emails. So if you email the governor, chances are she may read it.
She says she doesn't sleep very much.
All right. Well, let's leave it there for today. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.
This week's episode was produced by Anna Griffin, and our audio engineer is Stephen Cray. Our music comes from Audio Network. We'll be back next week with more political news from across the Pacific Northwest. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. Politics Now and all of OPB's reporting in our communities are made possible by the support of our members. Do your part to help make it happen. Become a sustaining member now at opb.org/pod.